here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Welcome to News 101. It's just after 5 p.m. on Friday, May 23rd. I'm Morgan Yee. I'm the news director here at CITR. And today, instead of our regular news broadcast, we have a radio documentary that I've been working on this past year with our volunteer, DP Lael. It's on accessibility around Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And around campus here at the University of British Columbia. So we'll be playing that for you today. I hope you enjoy it. And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. This is DP's third radio documentary that she's done with CITR and the first that I've worked on with her. And we hope more will be coming along. Here we go.
This is DP Lael for CITR News 101. I am a disabled person with a rare disability called metatropic dwarfism. This condition, not a disease, mainly affects my joints and bones. This means I have to rely on an electrical wheelchair to get around places. For years, accessibility in the Lower Mainland has been a major issue for many people with disability, including myself. I have had numerous experiences where I have had difficulty accessing various community resources. For example, some buildings do not have ramps. Others do, but are not set up for safe access. This made me ask, do people with disabilities not have the right to access their own community? There is always a lot of discussion about how disabled individuals should have equal respect and equal rights, but it seems like the province of BC isn't motivated easily. To answer this question, I spoke to some individuals who have thoughts and experiences on this matter. Working together with CITR's news director Morgan Yee, and my community support workers, Jen Bohm and Amy Tadaluk, I started by looking at accessibility at the University of British Columbia. I investigated the ways the university is working towards campus accessibility. Next, I expanded my investigation to environments outside of the university, focusing on two shopping malls in the Lower Mainland. What I learned from the experiences and interviews was that, for the most part, accessibility relies on city building bylaws. To further my understanding of this process, I went to City Hall directly. I spoke with a representative from Richmond City Hall about current and future plans to make the city even more accessible. The first interview in this documentary is with Janet Mee, the Director of Access and Diversity, which works with UBC to create inclusive campus environments for students, staff, and faculty. My first question is, Can you please tell us what your role is at Access and Diversity?
I'm the Director of Access and Diversity, and I work with the Student and Development Services Management Team on issues of student leadership, student experience, programming for students. And then within the office, I am the lead on the work that we do and manager of the unit.
Can you please explain what Access and Diversity is all about?
So Access and Diversity is a unit within the Vice President Students Portfolio who is responsible for working with university communities to create welcoming and inclusive and safe environments, both living, learning, and working for students at UBC. We do that work through policy review, through the development of leadership programs that focus on social justice, mm-hmm. capacity building with students. So our focus right now is really on active bystander and active witnessing kinds of programs so students understand hate discrimination and stereotyping and they're able to speak out against those kinds of things.
How long have these faculties programs been established for?
The disability side, the side that supports students, faculty, and staff with disabilities was established in 1991-92, and I joined the university in 1993. And then there was also the Women's Students Office, which had a much longer history with the university. In 2003, the vice president at the time combined those two units mm-hmm. into one and then expanded the responsibilities to include race and ethnicity, sexual orientation and gender identity, and all of the intersections.
What services and assistance does Access and Diversity offer to students?
The work we do one-on-one with students is primarily around support for students with disabilities. So in that circumstance, our responsibility is to ensure that the university meets both its moral and its legal obligations to provide every opportunity for students with disabilities to participate in everything the university has to offer. So that would look like, for example, for a deaf student, interpreting or captioning, note-taking in the classroom. It means that we work with campus and community planning very closely around issues of the built environment and how it's designed, work with instructors on universal instructional design, although that's something we're just starting to do. And then we also do things like we provide note takers, we have a tutoring program for students with disabilities, we produce alternate format material, so Braille, e-text, large print, audio.
And who is eligible for this service?
For the disability services, primarily we work with students. So any student who has a documented disability would be eligible for our service. We leave the agency with students, so it's their choice as to whether or not they come to seek service.
Have you ever had students who had accessibility issues at UBC? And if so, can you please describe some of those issues?
In terms of just the landscape of UBC, UBC is one of the largest physical campuses in North America. And we have this ambition right now to be a pedestrian campus, which means that if you're not able to walk long distances, it's a real challenge to get often from one class to another. And I would say in terms of the environment, that's one of our biggest barriers. Campus planning has been working over the last, I think it's 4 years, on what they're calling the public realm. So that's all of the outdoor spaces. And they have funding to improve those spaces. And a part of what they're doing while they just make them nicer is addressing issues of universal design. So if you come up now from West Mall or Lower Mall, you'll find that those slopes have been transitioned now, so they're less than a 5% slope. So they used to be quite steep hills that came up that area, and what they've done is they've used landscaping and other means to really lengthen out those paths and to fix the accessibility. They've improved, like, routes. They've taken all the routes out of the pathways. So I didn't understand at first what they were doing, but if you actually look carefully at some of the pathways, they actually go smoothly up and over where the route would be. For people who use wheelchairs or scooters, it's easier for people who are using a cane. There's less tripping hazard, all of those kinds of things. So that's one big one. Some of the others just have to do, I think, with the way many programs are designed. So things like group work for students who have difficulty in social settings as a result of a medical condition or a mental health condition, then sometimes that group work can be very difficult. And instructors, they consider it to be a best practice, and so they're reluctant to find another way to assess the same thing. So then we have to work with them and figure out other means of learning the same material.
What are the requirements students must have in order for Access and Diversity to accommodate them?
They do have to have a documentation of their medical condition or their disability, and it does need to provide a fair amount of detail. So we do ask for a diagnosis, but that's probably the least important piece of information we get. Given the fact that UBC is not yet universally accessible, we need to understand what the sort of the functional impacts of a medical condition or disability are so that we can figure out where the barriers are going to be and put some accommodations in place. And so we ask for that kind of detail, including things like whether medications would have an impact, what the prognosis might be, when, if it's a condition that kind of ebbs and flows, when it's most likely to be triggered. And then we use that information to determine what kinds of accommodations we would recommend to the faculties.
In the event of power failure on campus, what kinds of measures are in place to support those with mobility issues? For example, getting out of the buildings in which elevators are no longer working. And has this ever happened before?
So we have the sort of standard provisions, refuge areas. There are call buttons in the elevators. We would have teams from plant operations that would be going out to ensure that people that get stuck in elevators are freed from the elevator. And we would find ways to get people out of the building should they be trapped, like on the third floor, for example, when the power went out. It has happened. I think the most infamous time was during December exams. It was at least 10 years ago, and the major transmission station at the university was hit by a tree, and the power was out for, I think it was 8 hours. And at the time, we had no policy on power outages, so nobody knew what to do. And, of course, it was formal exams, and so some instructors were offering exams and others weren't. And in that case, no one was trapped because the power went out in the middle of the night. And so there were no students in residence that needed to get anywhere. And there was nobody in any of the academic buildings at the time. So by the time people got here and discovered there was a power outage, they weren't able to get to their classroom, but exams weren't really happening anyway. So it was not a problem. As a result of that incident and all of the confusion that resulted from it, we have a policy now on and protocols on power outages that would include making sure that people are safe in buildings.
Last but not least, what percentage of your campus is accessible for individuals with physical mobility issues?
I get asked that question a fair amount, and I don't have a good answer for it. There are very few spaces, one or two that I can think of, where it would be impossible to get to that space if you used a wheelchair or you couldn't climb stairs. One is in the theater building, so all of the costumes are housed, I think it's on the second or third floor of the building, and there's no elevator access, and there's no way of putting an elevator in there. International House is another building that has significant mobility challenges. And interestingly enough, it was opened by Eleanor Roosevelt, who was a wheelchair user herself. So it's kind of an interesting twist. And that building, we've looked multiple times at what we could do to create accessibility in the building, and there's just no hope. So we're just looking over time to move those student services out of that building. And then there might be one or two others. There was War Memorial had some challenges, but we've now corrected that with a brand new lift. I would say most, but not necessarily to the, you know, universal design standard.
Well, thank you very much. This was very helpful, and thank you for your time.
You're most welcome, and I look forward to hearing the news piece.
I then had the opportunity to speak to Michael Kingsmill, who is one of the project managers working on the new student union building here at UBC, as well as Derek Moore, who is the VP administration for the AMS and the student lead on the project. We discussed some of the ways the university has improved accessibility in the new set, as well as how this project first came about and some of the design features. I'm here with Michael Kingsmill. Can you introduce yourself?
My name is Michael Kingsmill. I'm one of two project managers for the new sub-project. And so I'm delighted to be here and answer some questions on our exciting new student union building.
And I'm with Derek Moore. Thanks, Derek, for coming.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
My first question is, what does SUB stand for?
SUB stands for Student Union Building.
Can you tell us what your role is for this new sub-project?
I am in charge of the architectural and project management services for the society.
So I'm the VP Administration for the AMS, and the VP Administration acts as the student lead on the project. So as a student lead, I'm responsible for coordinating work in between the student coordinators who work on the sub-project and the permanent staff. As well, I work with the permanent staff in talking to the our architects and other consultants that we have.
How long was the planning stage for this project?
About 10 years ago, we started to come to the awareness that it was time to put into place a plan for a new building. At first, actually, I should correct myself, it was actually to be a renewal, to take this building and renew it substantially down, and also to add a fairly large extension onto the building to meet our needs for physical space. But due to events, it became a new building adjacent to the current building on the south side here. And that one was in 2007 due to some events involving some planning on the square here. And we were invited to build a new building for the Student Society in 2007-08. And then we were in negotiations through 2009. We started to do the planning programming with groups and organizations in 2009. 2010, we really got into the working drawings and construction. So, and here we are today in 2013, and we're, 60% through construction.
Can you tell me roughly how many students are on the committee for this project?
Our committee is composed of both voting members and then the student coordinators and then permanent staff members who work on the project. So including Caroline, the president, also sits on the project. And then the two student coordinators, who are non-voting members who work in my portfolio, they also sit on new subcommittee. So we have a total of, 6 current students with 2 permanent members on the committee who I believe are both graduated, but they still represent the strain of continuity that's been there right since the start, and there are students from before, so they still kind of represent student opinion.
Why will there be a new sub?
Well, big one is that the building couldn't satisfy the spatial needs that were demanded of the building for clubs and organizations wanting to grow. So that really was the driving force, I think, for the new sub-building.
And there was originally going to be an underground bus loop in the University Square and the administration building above it, but that project actually ended up falling through. So once that fell through, we were approached by the university. Like, can you put a student union building on this site? And knowing what we knew about our current space limitations, I said, yeah.
When will the project be completed?
The scheduled completion is in August of 2014. We have had some slippage. I can't deny that. Whether we'll recover that time is uncertain. The project, while I mentioned 2014, it has another part to it that starts after the sort of new building is opened. We are repurposing some of the existing building for society's use, and that renovation only starts after the new building is completed because we need to move some of the uses that are currently down there to a new place.
Did you get any complaints about the old sub?
Well, I guess, complaints probably isn't the word. Comments, certainly, although the building looks old, the heat is never on, or it's always on and never turns off, or things like that always come to my ear. But complaints like, I can't stand being here, I've never heard that. Sort of yes and no.
Derek?
In my professional role, no, I haven't had any complaints. There's always, the space concern, anecdotally. From my personal life, friends tell me sometimes it feels like a bunker. So there's not very much glass, which is kind of sad, especially in Vancouver.
When this project was first thought about, was there any opinions, if at all, from students on how the new sub should be structured or featured, or how the accessibility should be?
There certainly was, and on that I must say we have gone very extensively out to the students to solicit their input to the design of the new student union building. I mentioned earlier about the program. That's the document where we sort of solicit all the input and analyze the existing building and project the future space needs. And we derived the program from a whole series of consultation with students and others.
Can you tell us what the new sub will be like accessibility-wise? For example, will there be wide aisles in the student bookstore or more elevators for people with wheelchairs?
Accessibility is a really big thing for the AMS. So our building will be fully accessible. The goal going into the project with all the different spaces was to have all the different spaces be 100% accessible. There will be wide aisles, like wide major arteries throughout the building for people to move through. I can't speak really well towards all the spaces. Some of the spaces, like our commercial retail units, haven't been fully documented in the plans, and we're still waiting on the final kind of furniture layouts as well. So those will go into these plans. But from what I've seen here, yes, it's all very accessible. I even know one of the considerations down in the Pitt Pub was we're going to have a stage in there, right? And one of the original design had a corridor running through the back of the pit, and that corridor allowed cakes to be distributed to the two bars on each side of the stage, as well as access for anyone, including people in wheelchairs, up onto the stage. As design went on, that corridor was removed in order to get the extra space, but what's being added is we're adding a lift for people in wheelchairs to get up onto the stage.
Michael?
Yes, definitely. There's much more in the way of accessibility within the new student union building. This building, built in 1960s, of course, did have some accessibility features into it, but the attention to those kind of issues was less than perfect. There's also the BC Building Code, which requires accessibility throughout a building 100%, but there's also above and beyond in terms of your own sort of up the ante and even do more. So we have all elevators are accessible to all people, and we also have all the bathrooms, of course. We don't feature just one fixture in the bathroom. There's more than just the minimum. We also have introduced accessibility for the hearing impaired, something that we don't have a very good coverage in the current building. We'll also be having, for the visually impaired, better signage, braille on all the door plaques and things like that, so that people can have equal opportunity there. So lots of little things, and even some bigger initiatives to acknowledge that this building is for everyone.
To further that question, how many elevators do you think?
I mentioned all elevators are accessible. In the new building, there are 4 elevators.
What are your goals for this project?
The goals, well, I certainly want to make this the best student union building that is on the planet. And that sounds very, that's easy said. But what's that mean? It means that a building that truly embodies the spirit of the student at UBC here, to have forward thinking in terms of how they view the society, how they view themselves as leaders, those kind of things, I think. And one where we're showing strong leadership is in sustainability, the environmental movement. I think those are things that we're all very proud of, that we've established those goals for the project and we're sticking to them.
Yeah, I think sustainability is like really, really important goal for any building that's being built right now. And I want New Sub to become an icon for students and their commitment to sustainability. That way, future UBC students can be reminded that that's one of the priorities for them as well.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, too. It's been great.
Thank you, Derek, for coming by and chatting with us.
Yeah, for sure. It was fun.
This next recording is of my interview with 2 employees that work for the Bay, located at Pacific Center in Vancouver. I chose this location to be part of my documentary due to the lack of accessibility for entering into the bay from Pacific Center. In my opinion, the mechanical lift that is built to provide access is not safe or user-friendly for individuals with mobility issues. For example, the weight capacity is 450 pounds. Which puts my electric wheelchair over the limit. Therefore, I can't safely use the lift, limiting my right to access the bay. Morgan, Amy, and I went to this bay location to investigate these accessibility concerns. In order to access the bay, you have to use an intercom system to contact an employee who comes to unlock and operate the mechanical lift. As you listen to this piece, you will get a clear idea of the barriers individuals with mobility issues face. We begin by attempting to contact one of the employees with the intercom. I'll let you do that because I can't talk in that.
Right.
You have to talk in there.
Okay, so I can push it and then talk.
Yeah.
Hello? We're looking for the lift service.
Nobody around.
We've been waiting for almost 2 minutes now with no response.
I know. One time I was waiting for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Yeah, usually someone talks after
you page stuff.
Yeah.
Do you want to check
one upstairs if that one's maybe not working.
Sure.
This one doesn't work. They should at least have a sign. It doesn't have a sign. Morgan went up the stairs to try to page an employee, but got no response. She got the attention of an employee by waving her arms at the security camera and indicating we needed assistance. Soon after, an employee arrived on the scene who kindly offered to help.
So it's been about 4 minutes and 30 seconds now, waiting for the lift.
Okay, so that's what they do. Come down.
Yeah. Man, this is so sketchy.
Yeah.
You can see it wobbling while it's coming down.
I know, it freaks me out.
Yeah.
My muscles get all tense and, yeah, it's not a good feel.
So sorry about the waves.
Oh, that's okay.
No worries.
Yeah, this seems like really complex.
Okay, I don't think my chair will fit.
You don't think it's going to fit on this one?
Yeah.
No?
I'm Dee Dee Lail. I'm a news reporter at CAPR for UBC. I introduced my documentary and asked if the employee could answer some questions for us, and he was very receptive to my request. So my first question for you, have you ever gotten any complaints about this? Because I've been on it before.
You've been on this one before?
Yeah.
We haven't gotten any complaints with the machine itself. The only problem we've had is our intercom, I don't think it's working. That's just when I saw you trying to flag someone down,
yeah.
I ran over. I think that's the only issue I've heard so far is just the intercom. But the machine itself, I haven't gotten really any complaints.
Do your chairs actually fit into this? Because I've been on it, and I'll be honest,
yeah.
It's like, it's pushing me right forward, like,
okay.
The backside, so I don't even know how larger chairs can
fit in.
Yeah,
how big, like, certain chairs are,
yeah.
Like, not a lot. Yeah, you know, like, most of the times that I've done it myself, it's either strollers or wheelchairs, and most of them seem to fit fine, so I guess it just really depends on the person that's needing it. I haven't, like, run into anyone with issues before.
Never had scooters, because I can't imagine scooters fitting.
Yeah, I haven't had a scooter yet. No, mostly just strollers and wheelchairs.
Will the bay fix this problem?
Usually should. We have a pretty good maintenance, people who take care of the maintenance stuff. I have some managers here if you would like me to get one of them as well.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. Just grab it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem.
I really appreciate it. We were then introduced to a deputy manager who was very accommodating and answered some of our questions about accessibility. My first question for her was whether there were any other routes to get into the bay for individuals who cannot access the mechanical lift.
Unless that you went up onto the first floor and crossed the street into the other mall, that would be the only other way.
Okay, and has there been any issues? Well, the gentleman right here told us there wasn't, but have you come across any issues regarding the lift from other people who use wheelchairs?
Personally, no, I haven't come across any other issues yet. I mean, other than having to hold down the button, but I think that would be the only issue.
I know for me, considering that I have a little bit of a bigger chair, I can't get on there properly.
Space-wise.
Yeah.
The only thing, as I said, would be this button, and you have to press it yourself.
Oh!
So press and hold down the entire way to go back.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I said when I was first doing it, this one's a little bit, you have to unlock there, then you have to come up here and unlock it. And then,
I didn't even realize, can you actually reach that?
No. What you just listened to highlights another issue I had with this lift. On the left-hand side, there is a button that you have to press down the entire time you are on the lift in order for it to work. Unfortunately, this limits who can use the lift, and personally, this feature means the lift is inaccessible to me. Even if an individual has a support worker with them, it is extremely difficult for the worker to reach over them and press the button while walking beside the lift. The deputy manager was kind enough to give me the contact information for the head manager to send in any further complaints, which I did. Here is what the email reply was. quote, "Thank you very much for taking the time to email us your concerns over your recent experience at Hudson's Bay, downtown Vancouver. We would like to express our sincere apologies for the inconvenience we have caused you. The lift at our top shop entrance at the food court does meet the building code requirements, but we thank you for bringing the size of the lift to our attention. We will take this opportunity to look at better enhancing the barrier-free customer experience. While not ideal, our store is accessible via the Pacific Center elevator located near the entrance to the food court from the mall. This would bring you to the street level where two barrier-free entrances to our store can be found on Georgia Street as well as one on Seymour Street. Thank you very much for bringing the intercom not working to our attention. We regret that we were unaware until this point that it was not functioning, but we are working on it now and should have it operating very shortly. If I can be of any further service, please do not hesitate to contact me directly." End quote. A few weeks after receiving their response, I returned to this location and found that they had fixed the intercom, which I appreciate. Their response regarding the lift and my concerns, however, was disappointing. Although it was what I had expected, ideally I had hoped that my letter would prompt some critical evaluation of what the Bay considers to be up to code and possibly stimulate changes that would make the space accessible for everyone. Technology is rapidly improving, and individuals like myself now have access to wheelchairs and scooters, which allow for more freedom in where we can go. These chairs, however, are structured much differently than older, more traditional chairs, and I feel the building codes need to take the changes into consideration. The next person I contacted was Charles Flett, property manager, Metropolis at Metrotown. In my experience of visiting Metrotown Mall, I had noticed several areas which I felt were either unsafe or inaccessible. I also noticed some barriers in regards to parking, including vehicle height restrictions. This is a problem because the vehicles which many wheelchair users use to get around are often taller than the height limit. Through the customer service office at Metrotown, I was able to get in touch with Charles. He was unable to participate in a recorded interview. However, he was kind enough to answer my questions via email. My first question was, "Can you please introduce yourself? What is your role?" The response from Metrotown was, quote, "Charles Fleck, property manager, Metropolis at Metrotown," end quote. When was Metrotown first built? The response was, quote, "Two separate malls were built in the 1980s and have since undergone several expansions and redevelopments to connect them and create one seamless shopping experience. Metropolis is now the largest shopping center in BC and the second largest in Canada," end quote. "Has there been any changes to the mall in terms of accessibility? Can you please tell me some of those changes?" The response was, quote, "We built a new set of washrooms which met all codes in the food court and other new set of washrooms on the ground level beside Sports Chuck. Additionally, the two grand court elevators were replaced with new ones to replace the old set," end quote. Do you get any feedback, positive or negative, about your mall regarding accessibility? The response was, quote, "We are always open to feedback regarding accessibility from both customers and organizations, and have worked with some organizations in the past to promote inclusion," end quote. It's been my experience that Metrotown has multiple disability parking spaces, but majority of the designated spots have vehicle height restrictions. Why is this the case, and do you tend to remove this barrier? The response was, quote, with our parking in the underground levels, we do have maximum heights to ensure vehicles do not suffer any damage by hitting the roof. We do, however, have surface parking located at various entrances to our shopping center, end quote. Are the mall and SkyTrain station associated together, or does TransLink make all the decisions regarding where or how the SkyTrain is used? If so, to what capacity? The response was, quote, the SkyTrain station is solely the property and responsibility of TransLink, end quote. Last but not least, where or who can Metrotown shoppers send their feedback to? The response was, quote, Metropolis and Metrotown shoppers can submit feedback at our two customer service counters, or they can go to our website at metropolis@metrotown.com/contact-us, end quote. Although I do have some concerns about aspects of Metrotown's accessibility, overall, I do feel that they are a good model for other public venues in terms of creating a space which can be used by all. At the same time, there are major strides that still need to be made, particularly in regard to their parking accessibility. Throughout my investigation, it became increasingly apparent that many of my observations regarding accessibility were connected to city building codes. To further my understanding of this connection, I contacted both the Vancouver and Richmond City Halls. Unfortunately, Vancouver City Hall declined my request for an interview. However, I was able to set up a meeting with a representative of Richmond City Hall. Victor Wei, who is the Director of Transportation, was able to answer some of my questions. He provided insight on both current and projective accessibility issues, not only in the city of Richmond, but also the rest of the Lower Mainland. To preface this interview, I think it is important to explain what a building code is. A building code is a set of established guidelines regulated by local governments to ensure the structural safety and accessibility of buildings. Could you tell me what your role is with Richmond City Hall?
Oh, yes, definitely. My title is Director of Transportation. So I oversee the planning of all the roadway infrastructure. And that includes, of course, the road itself, starting from property line to property line across the roadway. That includes the sidewalk, the tree boulevard, of course, the traffic lanes, the bike lanes, and also all the traffic signals and all the crosswalks. So my role is really to foresee the future needs of these infrastructure elements and then plan accordingly to accommodate the growth of the city. And also we examine any existing problems or issues such as accidents. If any locations of the roadways have increasing accident records, then we'll look at those areas as high priority for improvements. We also work with TransLink to help them kind of jointly plan for transit service improvements, again, to accommodate growth. And we also work with other agencies like Port Metro Vancouver because they have a large property in Richmond, which is located in the southeast part of the city. And as you know, they have a primary role to play in terms of accommodating for goods movement. So all these container trucks that you see on Highway 91 East-West Freeway and also through the tunnel, they most of them ended up in those areas. So we work with other agencies to help us plan the transportation improvements accordingly.
Just in Richmond or Vancouver as well?
We only look after what is within the Richmond jurisdiction. We do work with Vancouver city staff and also other neighboring municipal staff like New Westminster, Delta, to coordinate our planning efforts because transportation is really a regional matter. So even though formally our jurisdiction is just within our island, on a regular basis, we do liaise with other municipal staff so that we can coordinate our improvements seamlessly.
When it comes to accessibility in Richmond, do you personally have any input into the final decision-making process? For example, curb access to roadways?
Yes, I do. I'll give you one example. Recently, we have just improved number 1 and Mountain Street intersection in Steveston. I don't know whether you had a chance recently over the past year to go down to Steveston Village. You would notice number 1 road and Mountain Street, which is the key intersection in the village area, we have put in a pedestrian scramble crosswalk with some sort of artistic pavement design, and the crosswalk is like a cross. The reason I bring that up as an example is that we work with the Richmond Committee for Disability and also the visually impaired group to actually develop the new design for the push button for the crosswalks, the curb cut around each all four corners. And also you'll notice that we put in sort of a unique bollards, wooden bollards that have a notch cut out so that the visually impaired can put their hand on the direction of the notch to tell them where the crosswalk is actually going towards. So they can feel by touch of those bollards located at the corner of the intersection to guide them how to cross the intersection. And so every project that we do today, particular intersections involving crosswalks, we make sure that the people with disabilities can also have equal access to that crosswalk.
My second question is a two-part question. I have noticed that there is a lot of new development in the city of Richmond. Can you tell me about the building codes that are required when a development starts, or if there is an upgrade to an existing building? For example, is it standardized, and are there any different codes for public venues such as opposed to personal residents?
As I mentioned before, building approvals does not fall under my department. My department is called Transportation Division. There's a building approvals division. To be quite honest with you, I won't be able to answer that question in details, but I do know that the city does have building codes to adhere to, and those are the provincial BC building codes. So to answer your question specifically in terms of the type of buildings requiring the type of building codes, I can get that answer for you, but I do have to get that answer from another department head.
And last but not least, is there anything you would like to add or share about accessibility in the city of Richmond?
Yeah, no, definitely. As a matter of fact, I just made a presentation to the regional mayors at TransLink. And one of the purpose of the presentation is to really to outline over the next 10 years what the Richmond priorities are for transportation improvements in three categories: roadways, transit, and also what we call pedestrian and active transportation. What that means is like pedestrians, cyclists, skateboarders, scooters, and all that. One of the things that I highlighted is that we need to pay more attention to three segments of our population over the next 10 years. One is seniors, the other one is youth, and the third is people with disability. Because we have to start rethinking about how we plan transportation. It's not just for cars anymore. It's not just for healthy adults anymore. We are all aging, and as a matter of fact, over the next 10 years, we're going to see a very large proportion of our population with those three needs: seniors, youth, or people with disabilities. It's a proportion so large that I don't think we've ever seen before. So that's why we have to start thinking about how we plan transportation and how we actually put equitable investments into making sure that these roadway improvements or traffic signal improvements are designed and built the right way for these segments of the population.
Thank you for answering my question and giving your feedback.
You're very welcome.
During my meeting with Victor, he was unable to answer my questions about building codes directly. However, he assured me he would speak with the appropriate people and get back to me. This he did via email. I had several questions about building codes. The first was, I have noticed that there is a lot of new development in the city of Richmond. Can you tell me about the building codes that are required when a development starts? Victor replied that, quote, all new construction is required to comply with the current British Columbia Building Code, version 2012, and the city's zoning and building bylaws. Within the building code, accessibility criteria are covered in section 3.8, end quote. Through my research, I found the accessibility criteria covered in section 3.8 include standards for entrances, door widths, door handles, and street design. The next question I asked was, can you tell me about the required building codes in the case that there is an upgrade to an existing building? Victor's response was, quote, new additions and alterations to existing buildings need to comply with the current building code. However, advancements in new versions of the code after a building is constructed by themselves do not compel existing buildings to be upgraded if no alterations are proposed, end quote. I then asked, is the building code standardized? Victor replied, quote, the building code applies to all construction in the province with exception of farm buildings or those without human occupation. However, the building code is structured to recognize different building requirements in response to buildings' occupancy, classification, function, expected number of occupants, construction material, size, and public exposure, end quote. Lastly, I asked, are there different codes for public venues as opposed to personal residence? Victor replied, quote, there are different code criteria for design and construction of buildings built for public use and those for private residence. The criteria for handicap accessibility are more stringent for buildings that are accessed by the public as prescribed in Section 3.8 of the Building Code, end quote. What struck me from my discussion with Victor Wei was how willing he was to listen to my concerns and act on my feedback. My experience left me feeling that I had been heard and enhanced my belief that the best way to address my concerns was to engage in dialogue. City Hall and the representatives there needed to be told what was going on. Otherwise, they cannot work towards improvements. When I first started researching this documentary, my question was, do people with disabilities truly have the right to access their own communities? There are many barriers for people with physical disabilities when it comes to accessing public spaces. This is widely acknowledged, yet changes seem to come slowly. In the past, I have filed complaints and voiced my concern over the safety of some public spaces. And although officials have responded, no action has been taken. For example, at the Richmond Silver City Cineplex, when entering the building from the front or rear, the ramps are in unsafe areas. In my opinion and personal experience, this can put a person with disabilities at risk. Although I spoke to Richmond MLA, Richmond City Hall, and to the manager of Cineplex, this is a safety concern that has yet to be addressed by the city bylaws. The reason I've given the example is to highlight the purpose of this documentary. It is important that people share their stories, unite, and make a change for the better. As citizens, we have the right to make our voices heard, and if we don't use opportunities like this, what changes can we hope to make? As I worked on this documentary, it became clear that even if it may seem like there is little action being taken, it is still very important to have your voice heard. Don't be discouraged. There are many individuals who are very helpful and are committed to making change. Over the course of this project, I encountered many such people and felt that they were interested in my concerns. Meeting with people face to face was a really positive experience for me, and I feel like I was able to get a better response when I spoke with people personally than through sending letters and emails. I feel fortunate to have become a part of a network of people so dedicated to this issue. I would also like to say that in this documentary, I focus quite a bit on the accessibility of shopping malls. This is because a lot of people with disabilities, myself included, tend to view malls as areas which offer access to community, while at the same time provide ease of mobility. The floors are flat, there are elevators, and I don't have to worry about the weather. However, I hope that this documentary inspires people to think about accessibility on a greater scale and in more varied settings. Individuals should not be limited to certain social spaces due to lack of accessibility. As I was completing this documentary, I realized that many other groups of individuals are affected by the lack of accessibility to their communities. It has inspired me to start working on a second part of this story. Stay tuned for part two. As Dennis Whately, a motivational speaker, once said, there are two primary choices in life, to accept conditions as they exist or accept the responsibilities for changing them. I hope that this documentary has both raised awareness and upheld this philosophy. Thank you for tuning in. This is D.P. Lil signing off for News 101. If you are interested in viewing some of the photos of the areas described in this documentary, please visit the News 101 Facebook page. Round, round, get around, I get around, yeah, get around, round, round, I get around, I get around.
Where the kids are hip.
Thank you very much to D.P. Lail for that documentary. That's it for our show today. If you just caught the end of our broadcast, you can find that podcast on CITR's website, and it'll also be posted on the News 101 Facebook page. Thanks for tuning in. Tune in next Friday at 5 for a regular news broadcast. Thank you for listening, and hope to see you next week.